December means one thing for most college students, a break from studying. But for seniors with only one semester of school left, this is the time to start thinking and often to start worrying about entering the job market. Author and professor Mitchell Zuckoff understands this fear, and he uses this time to prepare his students for what the real world is like. He has this essay on the advice he gives to anxious seniors.
I taught my last class of the semester the other day. Inevitably, my students, all of them journalism majors and most of them seniors, hijacked the lesson plan to vent their hopes and fears about what awaits them after graduation. This happens every December, and every December I do my best to calm and encourage them, to let them know it's okay to be worried, but it's not okay to despair. I give them what I've come to consider my pre-commencement address. By May, they'll be overwhelmed with advice, distracted by pomp and circumstance, and exhausted from senior week. Any wisdom from whatever celebrity speaker my university invites to graduation will waft over them and be carried away. If you ask me, 6 months before we stamp them fully assembled is our last real chance to get them ready for what's next, to advise our smart, hardworking, and in many cases privileged students how to duck, tuck, and roll when they jump into the world with the parachutes we've helped them to sew. So when the final class of the fall semester turns to the future, I give them practical advice about getting hired and then succeeding in journalism. More importantly, I tell them some hard truths about life. First, I tell them to imagine a career ladder whose first rung is about 6 feet off the ground. That's the reality in many fields, where the perks, be they prestige, excitement, money, or, best of all, meaningful work, attract more applicants than there are jobs. It's always been this way, I explain. And they should embrace it rather than complain about it. They'll either need a leg up to reach that first rung, or they'll have to develop the strength, that is, the experience, the skills, the drive, the desire, to pull themselves up on their own. I'm a big fan of that second approach, having lived it, but I also tell them to take a boost onto the ladder if it's offered, without confusing what they've earned with what they've been given. Then I tell them to spend the last semester of college weaning themselves from the good life and the safety net many of them enjoy. Professors and university staff who care about their development and well-being, friends nearby and available at all hours, flexible schedules and relatively small consequences for a lost assignment or a missed class. I tell them that outside of a small circle close to them, they shouldn't expect people to care. I tell them to use this time to steel themselves before they start their job searches in earnest, to accept the fact that being overlooked or underestimated is part of life. That someone else will get a job they deserve or think they deserve. That they'll face anxieties about money and about love and about where to live and about whether they chose the right field and about whether they're good enough or smart enough or tough enough to succeed. Last, I tell them to keep in touch because I know how good they are and how smart they are and how much the world needs them, even if no one knows it yet.
Mitchell Zuckoff is a professor at Boston University and the author of Lost in Shangri-La. All Things Considered continues right after this. The social networking app Grindr claims 2.5 million users worldwide. Most are gay men who use it to meet and interact with each other. But NPR's Sonari Glinton reports that the founders of Grindr now want to take their success to straight people.
If you're looking for a gay man, you can download a form of gaydar for free at the App Store. When millions of men hear that sound, they know they got a message on Grindr. The whole thing was Joel Simkai's idea.
Very, very simple app using location and GPS, and it shows you profiles of other users and guys who are often within walking distance of you.
It tells you how far the nearest person with the app is, down to a few feet. You can use Grindr to chat with them or share photos.
We're big believers in bringing down kind of the barriers out there and having you meet people that are right next to you. That's what Grindr's all about.
And gay men are using Grindr to meet each other. You can see how ubiquitous Grindr has become in the gay world by going to Santa Monica Boulevard in West Hollywood. The very first person I met was Chris Lewis. He was walking down the street with Grindr open on his phone.
With person A, you could be talking about, okay, the latest and greatest news, what's happening. With this person over here, you could be talking about, you know, what you gonna do for the weekend. And then this person over here is trying to get at you, so then you could be sexting that person all at the same time.
You can't avoid Grindr in the gay community. That's according to Josh Jackson and Kevin Held.
Well, I don't know about the whole world, but I know that if you log on in this area, you'll see about, I don't know, 200 people within a mile of you.
I would have to agree with that.
The founders of Grindr want to tap into the straight hookup culture as well. The new app is called Blender. Joel Simkai demonstrates by showing me a woman on Blender who's just a few dozen feet away.
So here we have some information about her. She's from Arizona. It talks about her high school, where she went to college, where she works. And then if you'd like, you can chat with her. And the other thing you can also see in people's profiles is their interest.
So this woman here is a Buddhist, and she likes disco.
Right.
So those interests, that is essentially what makes Blender different from Grindr. You can sort or filter people so you can find someone near you who's interested in, say, knitting or your college football team or simply hooking up. But it's not good enough for Melissa Wyatt. She was out on the town in West Hollywood. She says all her gay male friends use Grindr, but Blender is not for her.
I mean, I'd rather like meet somebody who I actually know and comes with references. So, yeah, Grindr is all about, like, I'm going to pretend to be this, this, and this, and that's just a little creepy.
For Blender to succeed, it needs to convince women, says John Coopersmith. He studies the history of technology at Texas A&M University.
Grindr is essentially a pickup service. You know, how many people in the mainstream are going to want, especially women, are going to want something that public or that open?
Women, he says, are necessarily concerned about their safety. He says the challenge for Grindr is respectability.
Is this something that you want your parents or your kids or your workmates to know that you're using? That's going to be a big challenge for Grindr or any similar service.
Coopersmith says part of what made Grindr so popular for gay men is that it helped them find more people who are interested in them. The thing is, he says, for women, the problem is often not too little attention, but too much. Sonari Glinton, NPR News.
I got to find my baby. I got to find my baby. I got to find my baby.
This is NPR.
Some other news. Congress ordered the Environmental Protection Agency to regulate toxic air pollution more than 20 years ago. The EPA did that for most industries, but not the biggest polluters, power plants that burn coal and oil. The EPA plans to change that later this week. It is setting new rules to limit mercury and other harmful pollution. NPR's Elizabeth Shogren reports.
When Congress first told the EPA to put the brakes on toxic air pollution in 1990, pediatrician Lynn Goldman was in California. She was investigating the impact of mercury from mining operations on Native American families living near a contaminated lake.
We had children that had levels that were many times higher than levels that are considered to be safe.
Their families caught and ate a lot of local fish.
Unfortunately, we had to advise them to stop.
The fish had too much mercury. Goldman is now dean of George Washington University's School of Public Health. She says mercury damages children's developing brains, including their verbal ability. Mercury from mine tailings, medical waste, and especially air pollution adds up. It accumulates in the food chain, mostly in fish. Pregnant mothers pass it to their children. Studies suggest hundreds of thousands of babies each year are born with high mercury levels.
Because particularly the children who live close to these plants are the most affected by them.
Goldman headed EPA's toxics office during the Clinton administration and worked on limiting mercury. It wasn't easy. She says the power industry and its supporters resisted.
I think from day one, everybody knew that regulating mercury from especially power plants wasn't going to be easy. I don't think anybody thought that today, 21 years later, we would still be in a position where this had not been controlled.
When President Bush took office, the power industry persuaded his EPA to adopt soft limits on mercury. But federal courts said that regulation was too weak, so it never went into effect. Now the court has set a deadline of Friday for the EPA to issue a new rule. The language the EPA wants would require quick action. Within 3 years, power plants that burn coal would have to cut more than 90% of the mercury from their exhaust. They'd also have to slash arsenic, acid gases, and other pollutants that cause premature deaths, asthma attacks, and cancer. But even now, some power companies have been furiously fighting EPA's rule, especially its deadlines.
It's physically impossible to build the controls, the generation, the transmission, and the pipelines needed in 3 years.
Anthony Topazi is chief operating officer for Southern Company. Southern provides electricity to nearly 4 million homes and hundreds of thousands of businesses in the Southeast. Topazi says electricity rates will go up, putting marginal companies out of business. And he says unless his company gets 6 years, it will not be able to keep the lights on.
We will experience rolling blackouts or rationing of power if we don't have simply the time to comply.
It doesn't square exactly with our experience.
Paul Allen is a senior vice president of another power company, Constellation Energy. His company installed controls for mercury and other pollutants on its big power plant outside Baltimore. He says it took a little more than 2 years, and at the peak of construction, put 1,300 people to work.
We don't believe that jobs will be destroyed, and we do think that it's time to get on with this work.
Allen says the power industry had plenty of heads up this was coming. About a dozen states have already required power plants to clean up mercury, Massachusetts, for example. Ken Kimmel is the commissioner of the Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection. He says even though power plants in his state have slashed mercury pollution, his department still has to advise people not to eat fish caught in streams and lakes.
The mercury levels in the fish are still too high for it to be safe to eat, and that's because we're still receiving an awful lot of mercury from upwind power plants.
Upwind power plants in other states. He says that's why it's so important for the EPA this time to adopt strong nationwide rules with tough deadlines, despite all the political pressure it's under not to do so. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News, Washington.
For decades, young people have been leaving farms behind. The average age of the American farmer keeps rising. It's now 55. But recently, there's been a small surge in the other direction. Young people who've never farmed before are trying it out. NPR's Dan Charles went to find out why.
I should admit right away, I'm one of those people who left the family farm. Maybe the problem was I never went to a gathering of young farmers quite like this one. It's the fourth annual Young Farmers Conference put on by the Stone Barn Center for Food and Agriculture in Tarrytown, just north of New York City. 200 young men and women, more women than men, in fact, are dancing and clapping and laughing into the night. They're in their 20s and 30s. Some of them have their own farms. Some are working for other farms as apprentices for a year or two. Some are just thinking about it. They came here to learn new skills and meet each other. Earlier today, there were seminars on soil fertility, managing sheep, how to find affordable land. Now, it's time for the folk dancing. The Stone Barn Center is a gorgeous place, a country estate that once belonged to the Rockefellers. There really are stone barns here, also a high-end restaurant. These days, it's devoted to a new kind of farming, organic, environmentally conscious, supplying people nearby. That's what attracts the people to this conference. They're a new breed of farmer. Most of them are children of the cities and suburbs. They went to college. Now they want to grow vegetables or feed pigs.
I keep asking them why.
Essentially, it just was sort of born out of a concern for the environment. I spent the first 2 years of college with one question in mind, basically, how can I have the greatest impact in my life in the world? And so the thing that I kept coming back to that played the largest role that everyone connected to was food.
That's Brian Bates. Some of these farmers talk about what they want to accomplish farming. Others say they love the work itself, like Liz Moran and Roger Phillips.
Yeah, it's never a question for me. I mean, I feel lost when I'm not farming, when I'm not out in the field, and it's, you know, where I find the most peace and harmony in my life, and that's, I guess, what we're here for.
I love being outside. I mean, when I look, you know, I look around and, you know, you're amongst the plants in the sunshine, and that's my office, that's where I want to be.
Some like the feeling of doing something practical, like Kristen Carbone.
Having a skill was really important to me, having studied political science. I wanted to do something that I could, that was productive, that was real, and have a real skill. And to be able to provide, you know, my family or my community with something, a vital, you know, a vital element.
And then there's Lindsay Shute.
How did I get into farming? Primarily because I started dating a farmer.
Nobody really told me they're doing it to make money. This is an idealistic crowd. Some describe their farming as a kind of protest against the idea that success means a big paycheck, against big corporations. Lindsay Shute's husband, Ben, has been running his own farm for 10 years now. He says the great thing about it is it's a really practical kind of idealism.
It's all well and good and important to, you know, have political opinions and to protest and things like that, but when you're farming, you can kind of live your values and kind of, you know, farm the world you want to see.
Nobody knows how many young farmers like this there are. They certainly don't produce more than a tiny sliver of the country's food, but they do seem to be part of a real social movement. Organic farmers who used to spend part of the winter recruiting workers for the next summer now are turning people away. This conference, which started 4 years ago, has been selling out months ahead of time. But along with the enthusiasm, I also heard some uncertainty and anxiety about not making enough money, about settling in one place for good. And it's hard work for not much pay. A lot of the young farmers said their parents wish they were doing something else. It made me wonder whether they'll really be able to stick with it. So I looked up a real old-timer of the local organic food movement, Jim Crawford.
We had a huge day today. Everybody bought everything out.
Crawford runs New Morning Farm in South Central Pennsylvania. On weekends, he gets up at 4 in the morning and brings vegetables to a market here in Washington, D.C. When Crawford looks at today's new generation of would-be farmers, he sees himself when he was younger.
It was exactly the same things in my head 40 years ago, exactly the same.
In 1972, Crawford was in law school in Washington, D.C. and working on Capitol Hill, but not really enjoying it that much. Through happenstance, he ended up running a vegetable garden in West Virginia one summer. He really enjoyed it and got more serious about it, but soon the summer was over.
And I didn't really want to go back to law school in the city and everything, but I knew I had to, so I went back, and I walked into that law school, and I said, no, I'm just not going to do this. I'm going to go the other way. So I just walked back out and went back out there.
He went back to the thing he was ready to throw himself into, and he's been doing it ever since, even though it hasn't always been one big happy folk dance.
I can remember feeling kind of desperate and just having many failures, and a lot of failures. I mean, in the first couple of years of growing crops and not really knowing what I was doing, you know.
But there's one thing he had, a big reason why he's still farming. He loved the business side of it, finding customers, making a living on his own. So that's what he now preaches to his apprentices today. Hang on to your ideals, he says. That's important, but try to be just as serious about earning a profit.
You know, I do it for basically idealistic reasons, but if you're going to stick with it and you expect to make a living at it, you got to be realistic about the business aspects and the money and managing money and borrowing money and all the things that a business person has to do. And you have to accept that and learn to like that somewhat at least and be willing to be good at that, you know.
That may mean compromises, he says. Maybe it means burning a little more fossil fuel to get your vegetables to a city where people pay higher prices. That's okay, Crawford says, making trade-offs, but holding on to what's most important, that's what growing up is all about. Dan Charles, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Today, we're taking an extended look at education. In a few minutes, we'll talk about school choice and one initially hopeful parent's view that charter schools aren't measuring up to the hype. And a little later in the program, we'll talk about why some students are not staying the course when it comes to finishing college, and if there's something the adults who love them can do about that. That's all coming up. But we want to begin today by checking in with one of this country's most high-profile and provocative educators, Michelle Rhee. The former chancellor of D.C.'s public schools, she left after a tumultuous 3-year term there to found the national organization Students First, which pushes an aggressive reform and agenda that it claims would give America, quote, the best education system in the world, unquote. That's a bold promise from a leader with a reputation for boldness. In her stint as leader of D.C.'s public school, she became a national symbol of a take-no-prisoners approach to fixing public education. She was credited with raising student achievement in the nation's capital, but she was also accused of having a divisive approach that vilified career teachers and shut out parents. And currently, questions about possible cheating on standardized tests have threatened her legacy in Washington, but she remains a leading voice in the education debate. Students First marks its first year this month, so we thought this would be a good time to check back in with her. Michelle Rhee, welcome back to the program. Thank you so much for joining us once again.
Thanks for having me.
Congratulations on the first anniversary.
Thank you. It's been a great year.
Well, you know, you have always been one for benchmarks. So I wanted to ask you, what benchmarks have you accomplished this year?
Well, we set about starting Students First about a year ago and said that within the first year we wanted to have 1 million members, and we are closely approaching that mark. So we feel very, very good about the fact that we are going to meet that goal. And second is just what our members have been able to do. In 7 states across the country, we have enacted more than 50 laws that we really believe set the groundwork and the foundation for the children in those states getting a much, much higher quality education. So we're pleased with what our members have been able to do on that front.
Give an example of one of those laws that you feel is the kind of thing you'd like to see emulated as far-reaching as possible.
Sure. So this is actually one policy is something that we first put in place in Washington, D.C., and it is putting an end to the policy called last in, first out, which mandates that in the time of layoffs, because of a budget cut, that you have to lay off the least senior teacher or the last person hired must be the first person fired regardless of performance. We have seen through research and data that this policy has incredibly detrimental impacts on children. It really ensures that you are getting rid of some of your most highly effective teachers, number one. Number two, it necessitates the need to disrupt even more classrooms and fire more teachers because the least junior teacher or the most junior teachers are the least paid. And lastly, and probably most importantly, is that it disproportionately negatively impacts the lowest performing schools in the city because those are the schools that usually have the largest number of new teachers. So when we got started at the beginning of 2010, there were only 3 states across the nation that prohibited seniority-based layoffs, and our hope was to triple that number. And now we do have 11 states across the country who say that when in the time of layoffs, you have to do those layoffs by quality and effectiveness as opposed to seniority.
You know, to that end, your critics here in Washington and around the country say that this focus on ending the seniority system for teachers actually diminishes respect for career educators. There are those who would argue, you know, that at the end of the day, it almost as if the more seniority you have, the more you're perceived as an enemy of reform. It's almost like as if respect for people diminishes as they advance in their profession, which is different from the way it tends to work in other fields of endeavor. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think the way that it works in other fields is that the people who are respected, who are compensated, are the people who are most effective in the field. So if you're looking for a doctor for your child, for example, you aren't saying, well, who has been a doctor the longest? You're looking for the person who has the best track record, who has, who has ensured that that of the surgeries they've performed, that the vast majority of them, if not all of them, have been successful. That's what we look for in a doctor as parents. And that's the same thing that we should be looking for in our educators. I think that
doesn't experience have something to do with that? I mean, it's my understanding, just on the medical profession alone, that there tends to be a U-curve, that people who are just out, who've been exposed to the latest research and the, you know, the latest innovative ideas, highly effective very often, even if they lack practical experience, and people who have the most experience because they have that mixture of experience and real-world experience. I mean, isn't it both?
Well, actually, that's why you do have incredibly highly effective teachers who have been teaching, you know, 30, sometimes 35 years in the system. And you have highly effective teachers who've maybe only been teaching 5 years in the system. So you have highly effective teachers at every point along the spectrum. And that's why we think that it's so important to ensure that that's what we're prioritizing, is how effective is a teacher as opposed to how long they've been teaching. Because there are certainly some teachers, unfortunately, who have been in the system for a long time who are not effective. And for those folks, it's important to ensure that just because they've been there longer doesn't mean that they should have the right to have a job over somebody who may have been teaching a few years less than they do but are much more effective with kids. And I think at the end of the day, you know, we have to raise the profile and the respect level of the teaching profession. And in order to do that, we have to understand that not all teachers are interchangeable widgets, that they're not all the same, and the only thing that differs between them is how many years they've been in the system. We all as parents know that there are incredible differences between educators, and that when your child has a highly effective teacher, it makes all the difference in the world. So I think that in order to really respect teachers for the professionals that they are, we have to understand that there are big differences between people.
I'm speaking with education reformer Michelle Rhee. It's the one-year anniversary that was observed this month of her organization, Students First. We're talking about what she's accomplished in that time, what she hopes yet to do. But to that end, on this whole question of how you measure teacher effectiveness, obviously test scores play a role in that. And now the U.S. Department of Education and the D.C. Inspector General are investigating questions of cheating on standardized tests taken by city students during your tenure. Now, you've said you welcome the investigation because that's exactly
Absolutely.
The kind of thing that's necessary to demonstrate that, you know, belief and to further belief in the system. But given that there are other school systems like Atlanta that do seem to have uncovered credible evidence of cheating, mm-hmm. you know, number one, how can you be so sure? And number two, why might not that be a sign that the incentives to cheat are just too great when you put that much focus on test scores?
Yeah. So, I mean, here's the thing. I think that I have a tremendous amount of faith in the educators in this country. And I believe very, very strongly that the vast majority of professionals would never compromise their personal professional integrity and cheat on a test. Unfortunately, you're going to have a small number or an individual here and there who make the wrong decision. Those people should have significant consequences that are attached to that. But I don't think that we should say because some people have made the wrong decision, we should get rid of the accountability system first and foremost. And second of all, if you look at D.C., we had a teacher evaluation system which did count test scores as part of a teacher's evaluation, but it was part of a holistic picture. We also looked at their observations of their classroom practice, their contributions to the school community. So if you had bad test scores alone, you actually couldn't be fired based on that, just based on those poor test scores. Because if you were doing other things right, then you would still be rated as effective. However, if you decided to cheat on a test and we uncovered evidence that you did, you would immediately lose your job. So I think that if it was somebody who was thinking critically about their job security, then you would make the decision not to cheat on the test and to do right by kids.
Yeah. And lastly, before we let you go, I did want to talk about charter schools. And I do think it's important to emphasize that because you're so identified with education reform, I think sometimes people get confused and think that you led the charter schools in Washington, D.C., when in fact it was the opposite. You led the public school system, which I think it's fair to say was actually competing with the charter school system in D.C., which is quite, you know, robust. So I just want to just clarify that for people who don't remember. And I do want to mention that later in the program, we're going to speak to a mother who says that school choice and public charter schools are not living up to the promise that she had hoped, especially for parents in working class neighborhoods. Before we let you go, we have a couple of minutes left. I did want to ask you about what role you think public charter schools are playing now in achieving educational excellence, given that the data seems to be very mixed on whether they are achieving better results than traditional public schools.
Well, I think that, at least from my perspective, charter schools were never meant to be the end-all, be-all, the panacea of the woes of public education. I think that we should be looking not at whether a school is a charter school or a traditional public school or a private school, but rather, is it an effective school? And I think what the charter school movement has shown is that when you can free up a school and a group of educators from the bureaucracy, that it is possible for them to develop schools that significantly outperform the public school district, that take low-income and minority children who previously had been performing at incredibly low levels and lift them to the highest levels possible. Does that mean that every single charter school is going to be effective? No. Just like every single traditional public school is not necessarily effective in every school district either. That's why I think the important thing is to look at every single school individually. And then to, in the case of charter schools, if there are ineffective charter schools, it's important to shut those schools down, because part of the idea around charter schools to begin with was that you would have increased authority and autonomy in exchange for increased accountability. And if the school was not doing well, that school would lose its charter and it would not be able to serve kids anymore.
Michelle Rhee is the founder and president of Students First. That's a national organization dedicated to fostering excellence in American public education. She joined us from Sacramento, California. I do hope we'll speak again, Michelle Rhee. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
The smartphone maker HTC may have to pull most of its phones off the market in the United States. That's part of an ongoing patent battle between Apple and smartphones that use Google's Android operating system. Laura Seidel reports the U.S. International Trade Commission is set to rule on this tomorrow.
Before Steve Jobs died, he accused Google of stealing ideas from the iPhone. He famously vowed to go thermonuclear against Android, Google's mobile operating system. Nothing has blown up, but Apple has brought a series of patent infringement charges against HTC, which makes Android phones. Among the patents is one that lets you tap your finger on a phone number in an email and dial the number or move it into your contacts list. Julie Samuels of the nonprofit Electronic Frontier Foundation says the suit is in front of the International Trade Commission.
The only thing the ITC can do is prohibit any kind of technology that is found to infringe a party's patents from being imported into the United States.
So, says Samuels, if HTC loses, there will be fewer smartphones on the market. In court papers, Google has argued that banning Android phones from the U.S. would give Apple's iPhone a virtual monopoly. Some analysts say if HTC loses the case, the company could also try and purchase the rights to Apple's patents to keep its phones in the U.S. market. HTC can also appeal the case to the U.S. Trade Representative, who is part of the Obama administration. Laura Seidel, NPR News.